Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez. I've been doing news now for some 30 years in two different languages all over the world and certainly here in the United States. I've interviewed four U.S. presidents, I founded a billion-dollar business, and through all that, I believe news should be honest and direct and impactful. In fact, this show is Direct Impact. I want to start this conversation between you and I with what may be the most counterintuitive news that I can share with you, because it's a bit of a head shaker, really. You see, while everybody is focusing on the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait and the conflict in Ukraine between NATO and Russia and the ongoing chaos in the Middle East, there's this long-standing tension with real clashes that are taking place. I mean real clashes that are taking place between two world powers. Is this a battle that could be potentially catastrophic? Why? Because both India and China have nuclear weapons capabilities, and they share a border that is both disputed and fought over. And there have been many clashes between Chinese and Indian troops recently in 2022, 2021, 2020. And as you can see, as you watch these videos, the battles seem, my word here, Neanderthalish. The Chinese and the Indians are seen actually clubbing each other, beating each other, pushing each other, trying to drown each other in some of the videos that I've seen. This is all the way up in the Himalayas, where the land belongs to India but appears to be a part of China. And in some cases, you can reverse what I just said and make it vice versa, right? So while most people in the West barely even know that these clashes are ensuing, they most certainly are. And it displays an apparent sense of almost a hatred between these combatants. And I should say this too, because I think this is important. Let's not forget, India and China are the most populous countries on Earth. So as part of the Asian continent, they are part of a group of countries that make up 60% of the world's population. And for decades now, India and China have been locked in this bitter battle, this bitter dispute along a 2,000-mile corridor of actual control. Indian defense officials say that the Chinese military forces have been increasingly laying claim to these territories that don't belong to them. And now China is coming out and saying that they are ready to protect not only what they consider to be their territorial integrity, but also that it will battle to protect the territorial integrity of India's biggest rival, Pakistan. By the way, and this is important, they're also clashing along that disputed border leading to the area around Pakistan, which then leads one to wonder where is this all going to lead? When you have India involved, Pakistan involved, and China involved, and all three of them have nuclear warheads. The latest skirmish occurred in the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh. It's near a 17,000-foot mountain peak where India and China both maintain military posts. China says it was just conducting routine patrols, while India says, no, you weren't. They say they were encroaching into their territory. Meanwhile, some Indian politicians are now saying, look, enough is enough. This is Indian politicians, right? Example, Indian members of parliament. One case in particular, Rahul Gandhi, he's blasting his own government, the Modi government, for not taking the Chinese threat seriously. He accuses China of preparing for war, and he says the Indian government needs to wake up, his own government. In fact, here,
These are the words that he uses. I'm going to read it to you. He says, I have been saying this now for the past 2 to 3 years. It is very clear, he says, that China is preparing for war. The government, he says, is trying to hide and ignore the obvious threat. He's referring to his government, right? His parliament and the prime minister. So who's right here? And what is the U.S. take, right? What is the West's take on all of this? Could India be the key to the U.S.'s seeming need to go after China? KJ, no, thank you so much for joining us. This is an interesting discussion. KJ, you're a political analyst. You understand this region. I'm not sure why the world is not paying enough attention to this, but every time I hear about these skirmishes, these battles, really, between Indian troops and Chinese troops, I begin to wonder maybe why we're not paying more attention to it. First of all, what happens during these battles? What's going on?
Well, I think that it varies on the specific issue, but if you recall last year, there were some skirmishes in May, and then they built up a little bit into a really kind of a melee type of fighting.
That's the one in Arachnul, then, right? Yes. The big one was the one in Arachnul, right?
Yes, exactly. And then in September, shots were actually fired. So, you know, there's been different levels of escalating and de-escalating tension. Nothing that has been so serious as to involve, you know, major armaments, but people have been injured. People have been killed. We don't know the exact numbers. But yes, this is serious stuff. And at the same time, I think the lack of attention to it in the current moment has to do with the ambiguous status of India vis-a-vis the West and vis-a-vis the United States.
What do you mean by ambiguous?
Well, India traditionally has been an ally of Russia, and before that, the USSR. Pakistan traditionally has been an ally of China, and the four of them have created this, set of players that have sometimes related, sometimes not related to each other, and it's created a varying set of relationships. But remember, India was supposed to get on board for the United States Indo-Pacific strategy.
Yeah.
That's why it's called the Indo-Pacific strategy. Before, we used to call it the Asia-Pacific. Then it became the Indo-Pacific strategy because you had the Quad. This was India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. And India was supposed to blockade China along the left quadrant or along the Western front.
Right.
And it's a plan of encirclement around China. Now, when Russia and Ukraine became a hot conflict, India, because of its alliance with Russia, refused to go along with American entreaties to get in line with its agenda.
Yeah.
And therefore, since then, the Quad formation has weakened, and India occurrences in India have been downplayed in the media, especially this kind of friction.
Well, because India essentially is playing more of an independent role in many of these battle royales, if you will, between NATO and Russia and Turkey and Russia and the United States and China and Russia. And I mean, this whole thing goes back and forth between some of these countries. By the way, this one area, Arachnul, that we talk about, I think we're going to be able to put it on a map, and you're going to see that it almost looks like a peninsula that comes out of China with a very small neck. See down there on the south side? There's a very little neck that's actually part of India, and then it opens up and it becomes almost like an island or peninsula in India. In China. The geographical formation of it makes it look like it's really part of China. Is that part of the problem here for India in trying to preserve that? And who does it really belong to?
Well, you know, I think these borders are disputed and they go back to British colonialism. But the British used various differing borders at different times. They had 11 different borders that they would use for convenience at different
Well, and
times.
let me just stop you there for a minute because I want our audience to know what you really mean by that because I think you're being very polite. I think what you're really trying to say is almost 100 years ago, some white dude from Great Britain, I forgot his name. He had a name. It's actually been named after him,
McMahon,
right? Who was the head of
the
the.
McMahon,
Yeah.
yes.
So this guy sits down, probably with a bottle of gin and a crayon or a pencil and a piece of paper and a map. And he starts drawing lines separating the two countries, part of China and part of India, without any cultural knowledge or understanding of either, probably. And the consequences for what he did on that day, sitting there with that bottle of gin, probably, are the ones that we're seeing play out now. Did I overstate that?
No, I don't think you're wrong. I think that in essence is what happened, just as what happened, for example, in South Korea and North Korea, what happened along the Burmese border, etc. It's a white guy, with a map and a ruler deciding where the borders go.
What do you make of these comments by this member of parliament in India? His name is Rahul Gandhi. And Mr. Gandhi says, in his opinion, and he said this for the whole world to hear it, I think he's saying two things. A, that China is preparing to invade India, and in his mind, it's about to happen any day. And two, he seems to think that Modi and perhaps other Indian leaders are asleep and they're not paying as much attention to it as they should be paying. And I'm not quite sure what he means by that, but what do you make of those comments by Mr. Rahul Gandhi?
I think they're over the top. I think they're very extreme. China did have a border war with India in 1962, but then it withdrew back to the original line of line of conflict. So there have been conflicts. The last time there was actual shooting war was in 1962, but I don't think China has expansionist or imperialist designs in that area. Remember, China has 14 borders. 14 land borders, and most of the time it has negotiated those borders peacefully to the satisfaction of both parties, usually with China giving up quite a bit of territory.
How concerned should the world be when you take into consideration that we are talking about not just two, but three countries in that area, all of which have nuclear warheads?
I think it's very, very concerning. And the piece that concerns me the most is that the United States would like nothing better than for there to be some kind of a border war that bleeds out China. We already see that there's considerable disturbance in Pakistan, where the Chinese are building their Belt and Road. The CPEC corridor going down to Gwadar Port has been besieged with attacks in Balochistan. And so I think there is potential for further disturbance, for further kinetic conflict. And I think the same thing applies all along the border.
You're certainly not saying the United States would want to see some kind of nuclear engagement between these countries, are you?
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that if you look at where China has the Belt and Road and where China has borders that are conflictual, you will see larger or smaller degrees of conflict that may or may not be supported by the United States. And I think that is a very, very dangerous situation. Essentially, what we're looking at is a conflict between the US desire for continued unipolarity versus the Chinese movement towards pluripolarity or multipolarity. The US wants to resist this, and it's not beyond initiating kinetic war to achieve its aims.
We're going to be right back with KJ Noh. By the way, I have a podcast.
Did you know? Where I, as a journalist, as a Latino, as an entrepreneur, tell my stories of where I've failed and where I've learned. And we talk about success and we talk about growth. It's called the Rick Sanchez Podcast. And I invite you to check it out, and I'll see you there. So, when we come back, we are going to take a look at the Chinese-Indian conflict from a U.S. perspective. Is this something the U.S. will capitalize on, and how?
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back. I'm just sitting here thinking, and I'm thinking about what it would be like to only get your news from one place or one type of place. So I'm thinking, if you've only been listening to Western media, right, China is a pariah, the U.S.'s number one enemy. Our government is trying to find ways to put China in its quote-unquote proper place. We ship weapons to Taiwan, we ship weapons to Guam and the Japanese islands and Australia and Malaysia, et cetera, et cetera. We send battleships through the Straits of Taiwan. We conduct military maneuvers, and we even arrest the daughter of a Chinese magnate. But still, China's economy keeps expanding. Then there's, of course, the Belt and Road Initiative. China has used this differentiated strategy now to be able to expand its reach globally, and it's countering the U.S.'s more military-based approach to those types of things. So what's the key? What's the key to the West's desire to counter, even defeat China? Many around the world who study this geopolitical battle would say the answer is, in a word, India. India. If the U.S. could get India to really join forces with it, in essence, taking sides against China and against Russia and against all the other U.S. proposals, it could change the global dynamic altogether. And that may be why that border clash is more worthy of attention than what it's actually getting, which is why we are focusing on it.
We're back now with KJ No to continue this part of the conversation. And KJ, you mentioned that previously that the United States would probably like to see nothing more than some kind of dispute in that border that involves countries like Pakistan and India and China. And while that's unsettling to anybody listening to you thinking, oh, my God, these countries are very powerful, they have nuclear warheads, we wouldn't want to see that happen, you suggest there's several reasons why the United States would almost take some pleasure out of it. You mentioned Belt and Road, which obviously is an economic play. But then we've been watching what's been going on between Russia and Ukraine and seeing how the United States is just played into that full bore with the help of the U.S. media. And it seems like every week we send another $11 billion in armaments to Ukraine. I'm thinking, this sounds to me like a money-making venture. Would that offer another money-making venture were there to be that skirmish for the U.S.? And might that be another reason for them to want to go along with it?
Well, there's certainly the aspect of a military boondoggle involved. I mean, you know, war is good business if you are an arms manufacturer, or if you're a think tank related to an arms manufacturer, or if you're a politician who's funded by a think tank or an arms manufacturer. So definitely there's the aspect of, to put it kindly, military Keynesianism, where you're stoking up the economy by pouring funding into the military-industrial complex. But on the other hand, geopolitically, it serves the U.S.'s design in the fact that the U.S. is looking for unipolar hegemony. It wants to control the world. It's said this since 1992, and it has been working its plan and planning its work since that period. We're talking about Project for a New American Century, which became the Bush Doctrine, which became the Obama Doctrine, which became the Trump Doctrine, which is now the Biden Doctrine, otherwise known as the Indo-Pacific Strategy. So there's a strong continuity, and there are a lot of invested players that want to see this escalation, not simply because it serves them from the economic standpoint, but from a geopolitical standpoint. Anything that bleeds out the two center countries that they see as the greatest challengers or greatest enemies to them, namely Russia or China, they see as being to their advantage.
You know, I've been doing a lot of reading lately about the Vietnam War and coming out of the Korean War. And it seems like at the time, our fathers, I guess, and our moms were told that this had to be done because, you know, my goodness, there's this domino theory and these folks are about to take over the world. And they're communists, and if we don't stop them, they'll eventually be in your backyard. And we bought into that theory until the media wised up, and, you know, great journalism institutions like CBS News and the New York Times and started writing that this was all bullshit and that it wasn't true and that we were being lied to by LBJ and by President Nixon. And eventually the truth caught up with us and we stopped. To a certain extent, we did the same thing after 9/11, and we used, instead of the domino theory, the fact that all the jihadists were coming and soon they would be in our backyard raping our daughters, et cetera, et cetera. And now that's kind of waning, and it looks like we need a new argument, but there's a sameness to this story, isn't there?
Yes, it's exactly, you know, it's a template. They keep on repeating the same formula, the same tropes, and the same strategies. So this time around, China is the great enemy, the great Satan, and they're using the same kind of information warfare in order to delegitimize and to attack it. And then having done that, then what you do is you create, as you know, the leadership has said, you create, quote unquote, a binding strategy of other countries against China. And currently the thinking is that what you do is you provoke a conflict over Taiwan under the pretext of preventing conflict in Taiwan. It's all highly provocatory. And then once having done that, then you're going to rally other countries against China. Primarily, Japan will be on the front lines. It will, Taiwan Island itself will serve the role of Ukraine. Japan will be the kind of big attack dog. And South Korea, because it has the largest conscription capacity, will also be involved in Yoon Suk-yeol, the South Korean president, has already, you know, hinted that he's on board for this. Kishida has also said that he's up for this.
So really, you know, this goes back to what you were talking about earlier. And I think this kind of puts this whole conversation together now, which is fascinating. Thinking about how we started this conversation, we've got Chinese troops fighting on the border with in these disputed areas with India. We've got Pakistan looking along and saying, which side am I going to take? Most likely I'm going to go along with China because I hate the Indians. And what's the cause and what's the root cause of all this? And as you're explaining the rest of the enthymeme, the rest of the story and putting all the chess pieces together, I think we lost you for there a second, but you're good. As we put this chess pieces together, the missing piece, the missing link, if you will, in all of this for the U.S., if we're going to talk hegemony, if we're going to consider the enthymeme that you're making now for what the U.S. needs, it's India. If India doesn't go along with this, the U.S. is in a bad place to try and meet its goal, no?
I think it's very important. India is a very, very important part of this. Once again, as I said, this is why we're using the 19th century terminology of the Indo-Pacific. Before, yeah, it was always the Asia-Pacific. This is a Bismarckian term that the U.S. has brought back because they want India to be the left flank of this encirclement.
So they need India to be in a conflict with China. So they're for that situation. Speaking of the West, they would like to see more battle royales, as we said earlier, conflicts. They would like to not see India take Russia's side in the situation with Ukraine. They're disappointed with India for buying Russia's oil when they sanctioned it. And now they're probably disappointed that India is not coming out perhaps more fervently against U.S. sending ships along that Taiwan Straits, correct?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. And remember, India traditionally has been non-aligned. It's tried to steer a path between the Soviet Union and the United States, but it has a long and close history with Russia. And remember that Russia, or USSR, and remember Russia has close relations with China now. They are in, you know, they say they're, you know, they're closer than an alliance.
My thanks to you. Thanks for sharing your wisdom with us. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Before we go, I want to remind you of our mission. It's simple, really. We kind of want to de-silo the world. We've got to stop living in these little boxes, right? Where we never look outside of those boxes to see what else there may be. Truths don't live in boxes. Truth is everywhere. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm going to be looking for you again right here, where I hope to provide a direct impact.